This is CliffCentral.com.
Boom, 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 boom. It's Sigala with Paloma Faith and Lullaby. Just about 7 o'clock. We're going to get into some news in a moment. Two big stories that I have to bring up. First things first. Sia showed me a video of this FBI agent who went out to a party with his service pistol on him. He was dancing, and his pistol fell out of his shorts. First of all, he just had the... it was just in the pocket of his shorts.
In the waistband.
Oh, okay.
But still, imagine.
And then it fell on the ground, and when it fell, it obviously went off, because he didn't have the safety on.
Well,
and it shot someone in the foot.
Yeah. It would seem he was busy being the life of the party, dancing, and then he does a backflip, and then as that happens, the gun falls out of the waistband of his bunt.
And fires. Jesus. I mean, he could have killed someone, right?
He could have killed someone, but this other person got shot in the foot. I hope that person sues, because that's like
will.
An easy payday. Easy.
What a thing to happen. I mean, you know, this is where America, I take my service pistol to the dance. No, you don't. You could leave it somewhere. You don't need to. It's like you don't need to take your cell phone everywhere, and that's not even dangerous.
I was waiting to find out perhaps he was on duty, or he had just come from work, or something or the other.
No, he's wearing shorts. I doubt that.
Just weird.
Very odd. Very odd. And then the other thing is, I showed my buddy and Sia, I haven't shown Ben yet, but this couple are swimming. They're in a swimming pool somewhere in Florida. And a crocodile, probably about, just over a meter, right?
Mm.
About a meter and a bit long.
Woo!
This crocodile comes out of nowhere. You see it sort of going towards the pool. And then it jumps in the pool and starts attacking them.
Mm.
And, I mean, that's scary.
That's what they do, though.
Crocodile. And so he gets out of the pool immediately. Like, he's obviously like, Jesus Christ, it's a crocodile.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't expect that. And she goes into the pool. She's like, she moves to the middle of the pool, and the thing follows her and tries to snap at her.
Yeah.
So she smacks it on the nose, but it keeps going for her while she's trying to get out. And then I think she gets away without any major injuries. But my God, can you imagine the terror of being in your swimming pool and a crocodile climbs in and goes for you. I know that's what crocodiles do, Ben, but we don't expect that in our swimming pools.
Yeah.
Not unless you're in Florida.
Yes, sis. Right?
If you were out somewhere else by a lake or whatever, then that would make sense. But in my private home, I am just minding my own business, and then this thing comes in, and they just, like, move so quickly in water. So.
Oh, they're much faster than you. Mm-hmm. Much faster than you. You're screwed. Don't try and beat a crocodile in water. It'll beat you every time.
Yeah, I've never found myself in a fight or flight situation serious enough to know how I would react. And unfortunately, you never really know until you are in that moment. But I reckon I would get taken out very quickly.
Mm.
My default setting is to panic and scream.
and that won't stop the crocodile.
And that won't stop the crocodile. Like, this woman was hitting this thing on its head. Yo, I'm like, no.
What, do you just accept? Okay, I am now going to be
dead.
Yeah, just go on Google and look up crocodile attacks couple in swimming pool, and you'll see it'll come up. All right.
Well, crocodiles don't just eat people in swimming pools, also in lakes.
I know, and I've got to get to this because this proves there is no God.
How?
Now, I'll tell you why.
Oh, okay.
A pastor was doing a lakeside baptism.
I had no idea.
Yes, and it ended in disaster when a large crocodile leapt from the water and killed the pastor and dragged him under, it has been reported.
Mm.
Docho Eshete was allegedly grabbed by the crocodile soon after he started a mass baptism for 80 people on the shores of Lake Abaya in South Ethiopia. He baptized the first person, and he passed on to another one, local resident Ketema Cairo said to the BBC. All of a sudden, a crocodile jumped out of the lake and grabbed the pastor. Pastor Docho was said to have been bitten on his legs, back, and hands. As his horrified congregation looked on, Local fishermen reportedly struggled to rescue him. It was said they succeeded only in using their nets to prevent the crocodile from taking the 45-year-old's body into the lake near the city of Arba Minch. The crocodile, it is understood, escaped.
Oh my.
Yeah, Lake Abaya, which is Ethiopia's second largest lake, is said to be beautiful. Oh, sure. But the Lonely Planet travel guide does warn it has a large population of crocodiles, which are said to be aggressive towards people and animals, because the lake has few fish, which is their preferred food. It is likely that the crocodile that killed Pastor Docho was a Nile crocodile. Some Nile crocodiles can grow up to 6 meters long and can weigh as much as 1,000 kilograms, a ton. And some estimates suggest the species is responsible for more than 300 attacks on humans in Africa every year, just in that lake. 300 humans get taken out. It is thought to be responsible for more attacks on people than any other crocodile species, and has been said that the Nile crocodile causes the third highest number of large animal-related human fatalities in Africa after hippos and lions.
How do you even begin to fight off something that's a ton?
Nile crocodile is an opportunistic ambush predator. Humans are less powerful and slower in water, to Mubs's point, than any similar-sized wild mammal, and therefore easy prey. But it had to be the pastor, right? This is supposedly a man of God. Now, this is why I say that just there isn't one. Because why would the crocodile go straight for the pastor and take him? And he's trying to do a good thing. He's baptizing people.
Okay.
Bringing them to the church. Then, if you go on to this, this is down the rabbit hole of crocodile attacks, you will find stories about Australians who were camping in a tent and crocodiles crept in and bit the Australians, pulled them out and drowned them.
Well,
yeah. Oh,
yeah. What do you expect, camping?
Surfer survives crocodile attack after friend fights it off. Woman marries days after losing her arm in a crocodile attack. Crocs are really not our friends.
Well, wouldn't the sharp teeth and the streak and...
Well, you can see why they're a bit pissed off, though, because if you take their fish, then they'd be like, well, we can't eat anything, so you eat our fish, we'll eat you. That sounds like a pretty decent trade-off.
That's nature, right? That's how nature works.
Oh, can't think. Oh, what a way to go.
It's horrible, because what a crocodile does when it's... and it kills you, is it pulls you into the water and drowns you, and then it hooks you onto something underwater, and you start to rot, and then it can eat you. Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And sometimes if you're not dead from the drowning immediately, what it'll do is it'll grab you, and it'll twist and turn with you until it breaks something off, and you bleed to death, or you drown.
Yeah, because they can't chew, so they really just take chunks and swallow them whole.
Like a big chunk. Right. And then for that chunk to come off easily, it needs to be a little bit rotten.
Yeah, it needs to get, you know, torn off. Yeah.
Oh, these are beasts.
I hope you're having a nice breakfast.
Well, you should feel grateful that you're having breakfast and not being someone else's breakfast.
It's the least the crocodiles could do to humans, considering how they end up on our handbags and as our shoes and belts.
Well, you know these pastors, they like to roll pretty lit. He could have maybe had a crocodile skin jacket or something on. Very good chance. He had like a Nile crocodile belt.
Yeah.
Listen to this. We were talking earlier about the public healthcare system, and lots of stories are coming in from people because Aaron Mozzarelli is telling everybody that it's not a disaster, it's not falling apart, but there are people who are saying it is, like the health ombudsman. Hey guys, please don't use my name for obvious reasons. In the medical sector issues, when I was an intern, I fell asleep while driving after a 32-hour call and wrote off my car. Yeah. Didn't even get one day off to sort that out. Just a, why did you drive when you were tired? But the thing is, we never drove tired. If I'd never driven tired, rather, I would never have got home. Also, Sia, those rooms are purely for decoration. On an average call, your step count can be 30 kilometers.
Oh my.
I've done
goodness.
Blood work after a call and been in an acute renal failure from all the running and not having time to drink water. There is not a second for rest. This is horrible.
It is perplexing that the people charged with taking care of our health and saving our lives are the ones that are being most exploited.
Hmm.
And who dare has the audacity to ask you after you've worked like 30 plus hours, oh, why were you driving tired? Well, what because do you, propose
you,
I do?
You worked me tired.
Apparently, on top of that, they have to take the brunt for all the issues. They constantly take the blame for the slow service, resource shortages. Meanwhile, we're short of staff and doing around 3 calls a week to try to make up for it.
Yeah, you see, it's that problem. It's being short of staff that they end up working these ridiculous hours.
That's horrible. Sia, I want to call you out on your hypocrisy during yesterday's story about the University of Cincinnati. I find it hard to feel sorry for that woman, seeing that she had the very same idea the guy did by essentially labeling her a rapist. Would you be sympathetic towards the guy if he was kicked out of the university and had a rapist tag following him around wherever he went? It's sick and twisted, but how many guys have had consensual sex with women who later said that they were raped?
We don't know.
No, my point wasn't in labeling one right and one wrong. My whole thing is we don't know. It doesn't sound like it was an aggravated situation. You know, no one had wound marks or someone was forced. These two people had...
consensual sex?
Yeah, they decided to have consensual sex. And then, now, someone
just
decides...
They turned on each other.
Almost on a whim, yeah.
Well, because it was like survival of the fittest. Whoever got to the office to report the other one first was the victim. See? But it's a mess. The whole system is a bit of a mess.
So, yes, my sympathy actually extends to both of them, but really...
Well, both lives are going to be messed up. Anyway, good point. You're always allowed to argue with us, and if you make a better point than us, then you win. Only too happy for that. There is a God, Wena Gareth. Unfortunately, he does not accommodate stupid and ignorant people. Stats on crocs on that river are freaking out there. So people are just going to pay attention. But they built their homes on the Florida Glades, where even if Ben had to play golf, he would find signs warning him not to play from a water hazard.
Oh yeah, there's loads of gators and stuff down there. Yeah. I know PGA Tour events, they're on the fairway even.
Crocodiles can jump too. They use their tails to get height.
Oh my God.
That's right.
Oh my God.
That is some scary stuff. They can jump. A crocodile can jump. And then the same dude who was calling out CF for yesterday and his comments. Keep up the great content, guys, ever since I started listening to you. I've had nothing but pity for all those people who are stuck with mainstream radio. My car's Bluetooth automatically connected to radio this morning. What the hell? Can't even believe there are people who still listen to that shit. I'm so lucky that I have you guys every day. Well, tell everybody else. Let's turn the rest of them over to this.
Yeah, look, when it's definitely not rape. One of the saddest things in the world is regrettable sex. Oof. You know when you leave the bed and you think to yourself, I could have completely saved my time.
Yeah, I should have just stayed at home.
That was a complete waste of my time.
Especially if you spent money and
now it's going to be awkward if I have to see this person again.
Yep.
Like, it's so annoying.
And it can fall like either side, right? You could have a build up and it could be amazing. You're like all excited, and then suddenly when it actually happens, you're like
anticlimactic.
Wow.
That's what I meant, Ben, a few weeks ago. I wasn't sounding depressed or whatever. I was just saying sometimes this dating world is just not all that people say it is. You have to get ready and you shower, or you have to shave and you put on clean, great underwear and you clean your bedroom to impress these people. Then they come in and literally like 12 minutes later it was like, what? Was that it?
Yeah. And then you think to yourself, plus I spend X amount going to the spa today because it had been a while since the upkeep.
I feel your pain.
Yo, only for it to be mediocre.
Yes.
Yeer.
Oh, that's annoying.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
You see.
All right, but let's get into some news.
Okay, so Henry van Bredaar was in court yesterday because we are in the final season of this show, sentencing time. So the defense appealed to Judge Siraj Desai to, you know, be lenient when considering the kind of sentencing that van Bredaar deserves. And then in response, Judge Desai said, "Well, why don't you give me a human factor reason good enough?" I'm paraphrasing here, people.
I like this guy. I like this Judge Desai, because this motherfucker sat there the whole time with no expression on his face. He axed his whole family.
Yeah.
So, are you kidding me? Now we must take... Can you imagine the gall of this defense attorney? Imagine the gall. It's like, yeah, your worship, judge, we need to think about the nastiness of prison for this guy. Meanwhile, he's brandished an axe. An axe. Do you know how horrible a human being you have to be to hack your old family to death with an axe? Do me a favor.
Right, so the judge said, no, give me a reason good enough for the grotesque nature of this crime. And really, all the defense could say was, well, you know, this young man has no previous convictions, and he was young at the time of the brutal killings.
Oh. Well, now he's so old.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's 3 years older now. So, the questions are now being asked. How will Van Breda's sentencing be determined? And as you know, journalists have gone out and asked some legal experts for their opinion and also for their insights into the processes that go into these sentences. Okay, let's see here. We've got advocate Jackie Nachtigal at Law for All, who says that, well, it is up to the judges to determine the type and severity of a sentence in each case in this country, of course, in South Africa, because, you know, we don't have that that questionable jury system. While it isn't an easy task to determine the appropriate punishment, there are three principles that the courts use to guide them in determining the correct sentence.
Uh-huh.
The first one is the seriousness of the crime.
Well, that we know all about.
Well, three people lost their lives, and poor Marley, who we haven't heard of since the incident, you know, her life is forever changed. But yes, the first principle taken into consideration is the seriousness of the crime. Most will agree that it is only fair that the punishment must fit the crime,
yeah,
or that the sentence must not be disproportionate to the offense.
So what's proportionate to hacking your family to death with an axe?
Thank you.
Judge Desai will have to decide.
Gotta be like,
that.
I'm trying to think of something that's worse than maybe genocide. You know, if you've taken out a whole nation.
The court will look at the severity of the offense, its impact, and they will also explore various aggravating and mitigating factors. And then in the case of violent crimes, the court will look at the extent of the violence,
well,
the type of weapons used,
well,
the brutality of the attack,
well,
and to what extent the victims were harmed, amongst other things.
Harmed?
Didn't Marley suffer memory loss?
Brain damage. Yeah.
Well, there you go, even worse.
I am sorry.
The second principle that will be taken into consideration is the personal circumstances of the offender. It is easy to forget that criminals are human beings, but the courts do look at personal circumstances. They take into consideration the offender's age, his employment status, his health status, his level of intelligence, the criminal record, which is why I suppose the defense yesterday said, "Our Henry has no criminal record," as well as motives, whether the offender was intoxicated when committing the crime and whether the offender has any dependents to care for. The last thing that's taken into consideration is the public interest. The courts reflect on what type of sentence will be best, or rather will best serve the community, whether the sentence needs to stop a criminal from committing more crimes, whether rehab is possible, or possibly to serve as a deterrent to others.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think this is just unbelievable.
It's a lot more complicated than we thought.
Oh, yeah.
It seems a bit too complicated because, again, you go back to the nature of the crime, and that's got to be balanced.
I got
to
tell you.
Where was the consideration for his family? There's a consideration for him all of a sudden. But the axe going towards heads?
Yeah. Seems, yeah. Good point, Ben.
Look, if you go onto Twitter and you want to see some people think about this, go onto the Van Breda hashtag. There are some fiery thoughts. I mean, I know Twitter's a generally just a cesspool of horribleness. But there's some very interesting thoughts about how the double standards at play here. and how this thing's taking on so long, and how it's poor him, he's got mental issues. Meanwhile, other people get convicted of being murderers, they're just murderers. Yeah, so it's, like, there's so many different opinions around this. None of them kind of make sense.
I'm just appalled at the brutality and the weapon and the severity of this guy's activities. And you know, we if you shoot someone, you shoot them, that's pretty awful. And if you shoot them with malice and there's culpability and you could prove the act and all the rest of it, they go to jail, they're a murderer. If you chop at people with an axe, I mean, you have to have such fury and rage and anger in you.
Yeah, there's a lot going on if that's your choice.
We've got to get Dr. D in on this.
People talk about, oh, he's got no prior convictions. Yeah, but his first one's a pretty big one.
It's a pretty... Yeah.
He leapt from a couple of petty ones to the big one.
Listen, you kill three people, that's a very big... Kill one person, it's a big deal. Kill three people, it's a very big deal. Kill three people with an axe. Kill three people with an axe that are your family.
Mm. Yeah.
You know what I mean? I just don't know how it could get much worse. I think this is the most appalling crime. I can't think of one that's any worse than this. Help me if I'm missing something. This is pretty much the worst.
Sure.
Before we leave that story, I just want to throw this in from the previous thing. This is somebody who says, the scariest thing I have ever seen was when me and my idiot older brother decided to go and dive for crayfish and abalone. As we were shucking a few huge abalone, a big shadow appeared. It was a huge fucking great white shark.
Mm-mm.
We didn't move, and the thing just cruised past us. We got out immediately with shit at the bottom of my wetsuit.
Oh.
I will never do that again.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, how, like, talk about time standing still.
Imagine! Oh my goodness. Could I slot in another axe murder story here?
There's another one?
Oh, this time taking place in Russia.
Tell me more.
Imagine this. You are middle-aged, you're minding your own business, you are gardening, you know, working on your vegetable patch at your home, and you find human bones.
Mm. In my garden?
In your own garden.
Did I put them there?
Oh, no, no, no.
Oh, okay.
So here we go. A Russian man was digging at his vegetable patch in Russia. That's when
Russians.
He found human bones that turned out to be those of his partner's ex-boyfriend.
Ooh,
there's a twist.
I know.
Now you just go back into the house and pretend you didn't find anything.
This is so shady.
You pack your bags and you leave immediately.
Just get the hell out of
there. Don't even announce it.
Witness protection program, changed your name, everything.
It now has been revealed that his partner murdered her then boyfriend 21 years ago. Investigators have now opened a murder probe after the unnamed man found the bones in his partner's garden in this tiny village. Now, the villager, while digging over the earth in the vegetable patch to plant potatoes, look at that, just minding his own business with potatoes, found human bones and a skull. He went to investigators and they were able to discover that actually, no, these are human bones. That specifically is a human jawbone. So the man's 60-year-old partner then explained that back in 1997, they were having an argument with her then boyfriend, who she then hit on the head with an axe several times. Jesus. After which she dismembered the body and buried it in the vegetable patch. The woman then made up a story to her neighbors that her partner had gone away to work and no one came to look for him. So she is currently now under a travel ban. How nice.
That's all? She just can't go?
Nice.
What, so she's not going to be able to go to World Cup matches?
Pending further investigation. But this.
And this was 21 years ago.
21 years ago, back in 1997.
Yeah.
Guys, what is going through your mind as you are dismembering a body with an axe? What is the thought process? I'd love to know.
Wow, that's a tough piece of bone.
I mean, are you in... What kind of mode are you operating in? What kind of chemicals are coursing through your system?
I think at that point, you are reacting to what has happened. And if we believe her story, you know, like, what is her intention? She didn't set out like, you know what, I hate you, I'm going to kill you. Perhaps really it was in the middle of an argument, she saw red, she grabbed what is close to her, hit him. Well, listen, he hit him several times in the head, so you knew what you were doing.
Mm.
Yeah. Supposedly the partner had asked her boyfriend to not go to the cops. Like, look, I can explain. I can explain, or else. How do you explain?
I've already got the X in my hand.
Yeah, but then the guy was just like, nope, there's no explanation necessary here. I'm going to report your ass to the cops. How weird. Shame.
All right, I'll tell you what else is a bit of a shame, is that our economy shrunk by 2.2% in the first quarter of 2018. Wow. So if you're a Ramaphoria kind of person and you thought Cyril Ramaphosa was going to solve all our problems, no, he has not. And it's, I don't know whether it's his fault or whether it's all that talk about expropriation without compensation, but when you mess with the economy, it shrinks. This is the last thing we need as a country. It expanded by 3.1% in the last quarter of last year, but it's shrinking now. 2.2% down again. That's going to hit unemployment. It's going to hit spending power. It's going to chase up interest rates, all kinds of things now. Knocked more than 0.5% off the rand as well. GDP rose by 0.8% on an adjusted year-on-year basis in the first quarter, compared by 1.5% in the previous 3 months. Economists polled by Reuters had expected a quarter-on-quarter GDP contraction of 0.5%, ends up being 2.2%. On the other hand, the main positive contributors were finance, real estate, business services, and government. The rand has weakened. Off the back of the latest figures, economist Azhar Jameen says many analysts didn't expect such a steep decline in GDP figures. So there's something to think about.
Also, just a reminder that politicians are completely useless.
Oh, yeah, of course.
All of them across the board.
Especially when they start talking about what they what we should do with our property, which they don't own, which is ours. And if our investment fell by 3.2% in Q1. So how's that?
Well, that's the reality, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Deal with it.
All right. Well, I don't know what else we're going to do, but those are the figures, so you've got to pay attention to those. They don't lie.
A slightly better story.
Okay.
Saudi Arabia has issued the first driver's licenses for the woman.
Oh.
Is she still alive to tell the tale?
10 of them, actually. I was in the first sort of spate of liberalness.
And I don't mean that in a sexist way. I mean, were they not attacked by some men who saw them driving?
Well, okay, so the story starts off by saying they've got licenses.
Okay.
The story does not go on to say they then drove around socially and had a good time. They've got licenses.
Okay. Because I wouldn't be surprised if some of the guys try and run them off the road.
Oh, sure. Completely. Because, you can imagine what's going to go on now.
Yeah.
And it's going to be right of way in traffic, not a chance. But about 2,000 more women will be seeking licenses over the course of the week.
Mm.
Interesting thing about the 10 women who got licenses, they've already got licenses in other countries, such as the US, the UK, Lebanon, and Canada.
Mm. So the fact is that they just couldn't get a license in their home country.
Yeah.
What a mess.
But yeah, they did all the tests. They go for the eye test, and hey, presto, you can drive. Mm. So it's a nice story. A lot of people are saying it's just propaganda bullshit, basically.
Let's just remember, this is 2018. And women have been able to drive in most countries for the last 50 to 60 years.
There's even in Saudi Arabia now, even, hold your chair, there's parts of society where women can make free choice, as in what they want to do with their lives, and not ask their fathers, husbands, or relatives for consent. Like, they can actually go and maybe get a job at Starbucks.
Surely you jest.
Well, guys.
No way, Ben.
I like to keep my finger on the pulse of all things happening in the Arab world. And yes, that's something, slowly but surely.
Hmm.
I just hope it is a step in the right direction, and it's not just lip service, the fact that they're not completely oppressive and dreadful.
You know, I'd love to sit with a woman from that part of the world and just get her account on how oppressed she feels, if that at all. Because, well, you know, when you're only exposed to certain experiences in your life,
yep.
you might not even feel oppressed because you're not aware that in a different part of the world, things are so different.
Mm-hmm. It's like Stockholm syndrome.
I'd love to get their perspective and not have everybody...
Well, you're not allowed to interview them without their husbands.
I know, but I'm just saying, I'd love to get a sense of...
Well, there are a couple of interesting documentaries on Netflix where they actually interview one woman who, such a badass, she was driving about 2 years ago. She got arrested, obviously.
Yeah.
And she was detained and, yeah, she went missing for a bit. But yes, they interviewed her. They interviewed people similar to her.
And also, what you point out here is correct. Like, that's their reality. They don't know any better. That it's a world that they've grown up in. Mm. They're used to. They're immersed in it. It's a lot like Stockholm syndrome. You know, when someone gets abducted and then their kidnapper becomes special to them, becomes important to them because the kidnapper provides food and security and warmth. Sometimes there's a sort of weird relationship they start having. It's almost like that. And then they start believing that the best condition for them is to be imprisoned or to be kidnapped. So I suppose it would be the same thing here. If that's what you're used to, then that's what you think is right.
But in this day and age, and particularly with this cause, it must be frustrating because you know what's going on elsewhere in the world. You know, it's just like... For example, gay people in countries where they can't get married. They know what goes on elsewhere in the world. They know that they are deprived in a certain way. And that
Do they? Because, I mean, in certain parts of the world, like, the internet is not available to everybody. You know, they just don't know. Yeah. If you're in some rural village somewhere, you might not necessarily have the internet. How would you know it's better? You think that what you've got is the best it could be.
Imagine a 23-year-old leaving North Korea for the first time coming to this country, Sia. Their minds would be completely blown. Because in that part of the world...
Sorry. No, it's not funny. It's not
you know
funny.
What I mean?
They would be asking for permission for everything.
It would be such a different experience for that 23-year-old. Same age as you.
No, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be insensitive. I'm laughing at the weirdest thing. Very long story short, I went out this weekend on like Friday night. I went out to this gay club and there was this proper... Afrikaner guy, and I think this was his twisted version of trying to hit on me. He walks up to me and he goes, "Hey," I'm like, "Okay, what is going on?" He says, "You're black and gay. You know, you would get killed for that where I come from." Excuse me, like, what the actual?
Do you think he was hitting on you? Jesus, that's some open.
Like, are you trying to make conversation?
That's some opener, yeah.
Because that is not a way to start something off. So, yeah, anyway, no. People live in different odd worlds. Yes, my brother.
Wow.
So weird.
Yeah, look, I'm so grateful I was born when I was born, and I'm so grateful I was born in a country which changed while I was living in it. Because I hear people talking about the good old days, and I get so uncomfortable. I'm like, really, those good old days where you couldn't read some things in the news, you didn't have access to books and music from overseas if the censor board got in between you and them. Mm. You couldn't express yourself for fear of being put in a prison cell. It's just, you know, the world is changing. Got to move with the times. Saudi Arabia's like the kid at the back. Saudi Arabia's like when you all used to run, your whole class would run around the field or something. Mm-hmm. There was always that fat kid at the back who just never really managed to catch up to anybody. That's how Saudi Arabia is. And for the women in that country, even if they don't know that they've got it bad, even if they don't know what it's like to drive a car because... they think it's perfectly normal that women don't drive. Well, I hope for your sake you get to experience that change. Get to experience some freedom.
And how really, deep down in yourself, can you be upset or question change that is trying to help everybody else around you enjoy the same benefits that you do? How do you want to be the only person to have certain privileges?
Well... interestingly, on the line talking about this, we've got Donald Trump.
Oh.
Hello, hey, how are you?
Hey, Trump.
Yeah, it's good to speak to you, too. I can hear you really, really tremendously thrilled to have me.
So what's with you and Kim Jong-un, the whole North Korea thing?
We're talking. Kim is very excited. I'm very optimistic. We're going to meet on the 12th. We're going to have a meeting in Singapore.
Right.
It's going to be a great meeting. Everybody's going to be very pleased.
Of course.
We're going to save the world.
Yeah. So
it's tremendous.
Right.
Terrific. Really terrific. Did I mention how great it's going to be?
Well, you didn't, but thank you for adding that last bit.
Amazing. Fantastic.
Tell me, have you...
I have been the most great peacemaker that ever existed.
Okay.
When I surprise everybody with this, I better get 4 Nobel Prizes.
Right.
Obama got 1. He didn't deserve any. I deserve 4.
Yeah. Listen, quickly, I just want to ask you about 2 things. Firstly, have you been in touch with Roseanne Barr? Have you, like, phoned her to just, check in on how she's doing?
I have been speaking to a lot of people. A lot of people. And they've been telling me that they're very upset about this Roseanne situation.
Upset. Are you upset?
I'm very upset about the Roseanne situation.
Why?
Because this is a comedian. This is a woman with mental health problems. And she was a big supporter of mine.
Right.
Great person. Great person. Have you ever met Roseanne? I've met her. She's a great person. Mm.
You really do.
She's terrific. Can I tell you how great Roseanne is?
No,
very funny woman.
Right.
Very talented.
Yeah.
Very good looking.
Okay.
Not as good looking as Ivanka, but good looking.
Well, of course, nobody's ever as good looking as
Not like Rosie O'Donnell.
Right.
Or Hillary Clinton.
So.
Very ugly. Very unattractive.
Okay.
Very nasty.
Yeah.
Nasty women, those two.
Yeah.
Nasty.
Yeah. But you know, your other pal, Kanye West.
Oh, we love Kanye.
Of course you do.
Do you know that my black support went up by 40%? Sorry, 50%. Did I say 60%?
No, you said 40.
70% is what I meant. As soon as Kanye came out in favor of me.
Right.
Very big. I've done more for African-American unemployment than any president before. Anyone.
Than any,
including the black guy.
Then all 40.
Did I point that out?
Sorry, what number are you now? 46?
I am the 45th president of the United States.
So you have done
more. Or is it 46th? I could be 47th as well, if you want me to.
You know what?
I could be all of those.
It's okay.
I am tremendous.
So, you and Kim Kardashian spoke about what, exactly?
Oh, I thought you meant Kim Kardashian. I thought you meant Kim Jong-un.
No, I did mean Kim Jong-un in the
There's
first...
There's a lot of Kims.
I'm
the president of Kims.
How do you keep up with all your Kims?
I try to remember one is a man from Asia, the other one is a woman from Calabasas.
Right.
Yeah.
Prison reform,
so
right?
So Kim Kardashian.
Yes.
This is a very, very strong, independent woman. She's fighting for prisoners. She's very passionate.
Yeah.
Kim Kardashian. Very passionate. Great ass.
Right.
In touch with the prison populations and prison reform. She came to speak to me. She's a great speaker. Did I mention that she told me amazing things?
Okay.
Like how good I looked.
Oh.
How good my hair was. How perfectly long my tie was.
I mean, not that you care about that.
I don't, you know. I was not distracted from the issues at hand.
No, you don't need to be reaffirmed in that way. You're one of the most confident people in the world.
Did I mention how rich I am as well?
You know what? We've actually got to go. We've just run out of time.
Let me talk to you for half an hour about how rich I am.
You know what? Thanks to the internet, we can read all about it.
Wow, that was going on forever. Glad you got rid of him.
I don't like being left alone with these people.
Sorry, I don't have anything to say to Trump. All right, let's talk to Chantel Stanfield. She's coming in next. We're going to talk to her about a role in a new show called Cook Sisters to Knedlach. Yes, it's an uplifting theatrical treat. Embraces diversity and warmth and humor. And I know her from every night we used to see each other for weeks on end. Well, every week we would see each other for weeks on end at Idols, because she is R.J. Benjamin's wife. Yeah. And she used to come to the shows, support him. She's now doing this show of her own. So she's going to pop by and talk to us about the show. She's going to talk about her career so far. And it's a pretty damn interesting story, too. The production runs from the 12th to the 23rd of June. It's at the Theatre on the Square, the Auto and General Theatre on the Square here in Sandton. 6 performances a week. You're going to be tired.
I think it might be more. Wait, is my maths wrong?
Six a week.
Tuesday to Saturday, two on Saturdays. That's six.
If you're not able to count, you're in great company.
Well, I did
because we all suck at maths.
I did maths on standard grade. So.
Shame, you were looking at us like we would help you add this up. The only one who sort of can is Ben.
And I get no credit for it.
No, we ignore him. When he gives us a number, we just don't believe him until we've pulled out our calculators. Anyway, so six performances a week you're going to be doing.
Yeah. I mean, surprisingly, this run is actually the shortest of the three runs that the show's done now. Over the first season, it was 4 weeks at the Baxter Theatre. And last year, the first run of the show at the Stanton A&G Theatre on the Square was 3 weeks. So this is actually easier on me.
Well,
it's crazy, but yeah.
This is an incredible role to play because it's a mostly accurate personal story for you of what happened to you when you entered the world of Jewish Joburg.
Yeah.
And you had to navigate that because your boyfriend at the time, your now husband's family, were Jewish. And you had no idea how that whole culture worked.
No, not a clue.
Yeah, because we'll talk about your circumstances, your own culture and where you come from in a minute and compare the two. Mm. But then you wrestled with something that I think a lot of people wrestle with in South Africa, your identity, the labels, the way you get treated, both by the people you're trying to integrate into and the people that you're still a part of.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody thinks that you belong to them, or people don't want you to belong to
them.
You
don't belong in any boxes.
Right, so it's very frustrating, and this is something that I want to talk to you about in a minute. Just first of all, well done. I mean, to be able to put a show like this together and then be able to have the runs that you have had with this is tremendous. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. It was a huge risk and a huge chance that I took, but I decided, you know, no one else is really going to back me unless I back myself. And it was at a turning point in my career when I actually wanted to leave the industry about 4 years ago because I got sick of the drama, the backstabbing.
Yeah, people
the
are
underhanded.
Shit. They really are.
Really. And to the point where, you know, contracts are signed and then you want to negotiate for, you know, overtime, which is a decent thing to have. And then the next day you get recast. That kind of thing. And
do you think the theater world is nastier than and more difficult to navigate than any other performing arts world? I mean, I speak to comedians and they say that it's tough there, but they kind of have a bit of a camaraderie going.
Oh, yeah. I actually think that the TV world is more of a problem than theater. Look, theater in itself, especially I would say the musical theater side of things, is very insidious and very
incestuous.
Yes, that's the word as well. It's
everybody knows everyone. Everyone slept with everyone.
And everybody wants to.
They're all competing for different roles.
Oh, it's very tiring. So there's a very like love hate relationship with musical theater for me especially. But I think within theater, as proper actors, you know, we kind of think or pretend that we're proper thespians. There's not as much BS. But it really, I decided, you know, well, screw this. I'm not going to pander to what people expect. I'm not going to fit into whatever box people want to fit me into. I'm going to just back myself, write my own stuff, write what I know, and try to present myself as a performer, but then also to tell what I think is a really interesting, fascinating story for South Africa.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the main thing. Like, yeah, okay, cool, I'm on stage doing my thing. But the impact that the show's had has been incredible. And to get the stories from people who've gone through the same thing in different guises has been very inspiring. After a show, I don't usually go out into a foyer for various reasons. But with this show, I felt I had to.
Yeah.
Because I knew that
there was a discussion afterwards.
Exactly. And it was those kind of discussions that kind of fueled the next show. And the
you know, Chantal, I have to say, I had an ulterior motive when I saw you were doing this show to have you in here and talk about it. That is because I hate labels and boxes too.
Yeah.
And you're someone who's either by your own design, you know, the heart wants what it wants. Who knows why you and RJ found each other and fell in love. But it's such a battle to keep everybody. Everybody thinks they own you, and everybody thinks that they can give you a label.
Exactly.
And they like to put you in the simplest possible box that they can so that they can understand you. And then they just cover all your personality traits and all the different things about you with one label, and it's easy to file you into a set of drawers.
Exactly. And I think from a very early age, I eschewed, if that's the right word.
Yes, it is.
743.
Right. How's that? Eschewed. Yeah,
I kind of try to eschew, stay away from those kind of labels because, like I say in the piece, in 1991, my parents moved me from the school in the hood, Denegier Primary, to the school in the not hood, Musenberg Junior, as the doors were opening. This was before Mandela, was it after Mandela was freed? Yeah, but before the elections, way before the elections.
Right.
So from a very early age, I was very aware that, yeah, there were boxes and labels, but I'm not going to fit into any of those, so I'm just going to make my own path.
So you grew up in Cape Town.
Yeah.
And you, your parents had, they obviously wanted to give you the best possible future.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, coming from some of those hoods, as you call them, some of those neighborhoods in Cape Town, it's not always easy. And you don't know whether, you don't know whether there's going to be some gangster on the street that night shooting at people, whether or not you're going to be able to get to school the next morning.
Exactly.
Whether your parents are going to be able to do what they want to do to provide for you.
Yeah.
It's a tough way to grow up.
And it is.
Completely different to the way that RJ grew up, for example.
Oh, totally. I mean, we have those kind of discussions all the time. Like, one of the first discussions we had was, I grew up with Malta Bella and, what's the white one? The white pup, whatever it is. And he had, you know, the South African version of Captain Crunch.
Yeah.
And little thingies and the things like, you see.
Turns
you
out
see.
You were healthier, you just didn't know.
Exactly, you know, strong genes. But yeah, I mean, the background, I come from Strandfontein, which is, I would say, a kind of a nicer version of Mitchell's Plain, next to Mitchell's Plain. And we like to think that we're a bit better than everyone else.
Every neighborhood.
You know?
Looks askance at the neighborhood next door, right?
So I think I had it good because my father was in the Navy and he was actually one of the first officers of color in the Navy in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he, by
the late 70s?
Exactly.
Sure. He must have been impressive.
I mean, look, there were articles
in the paper. Because they wouldn't have advanced anyone of color in those days. In the 70s?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? In the military?
This was 79, if I remember correctly.
The apartheid government didn't like the idea of people of color being in the military, first of all.
Yeah. And
second of all, them being competent in the military.
Yeah.
Third of all, them being leaders and officers in the military. Jesus, this guy must be amazing.
He is pretty cool. So there was that kind of impression from a very early age that, I suppose he was a bit of a trailblazer.
Oh,
so
couldn't be ignored.
Exactly. So I think being the eldest of two kids, I think I kind of had that subconscious pressure to, you know, succeed and do the best that I could in my chosen field.
And I don't want to skip through too much of this because there's a lot in it that probably is a story on its own, and I'm sure you cover some of this in the show. But going into drama then and being able to express yourself is a big part of this. I think a lot of people in South Africa who grow up in tough circumstances or grow up in a neighborhood where they, you know, sometimes have to fight for every square inch that they get and for every meal and all the rest of it, they don't always learn how to express themselves. And that's a source of great frustration.
Yeah. I think for me it still is a source of frustration personally because I feel like I know what I want, and I, for the most part, kind of know how I want to get there. It's not easy, but I suppose it's because sometimes I look at people and I'm like, why are you being so stupid? Just like do the thing that you're supposed to do, and you'll be fine. Maybe it's also because of my upbringing and where I've come from and what I've had to do. Wake up at 4 in the morning to get a bus at the first early morning bus at 5 to get to Rondebosch Upper Campus UCT by 7:30 for lecture at 8. I'm like, that's 2.5 hours, 3 hours before I've even learned anything. And now you want to complain because, oh, there's no hot water. I'm like, really? Really now? So, I don't know. But I think there's a great fighting spirit that we have on the flats, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. So, you either use that for your own advancement in a positive or negative way.
Yeah, and a lot of people do choose to use it for a negative purpose, and, you know, they end up successful in terms of, I mean, they can.
Yeah.
They can be successful, but then they're not necessarily the kind of people that you want around to your house for dinner. And similarly, there are so many success stories. And not just from the flats, but you know, all over South Africa, there are people who've overcome incredible adversity. But I don't want to get stuck on this because you have done, you know, years and years of TV as well. Mm-hmm. So you've been in Seven de Laan, Geraldine de Tweede, Montana, Rudy Futa. You've done a lot of shows. How did you and RJ meet?
So, bizarre story. So, originally, this isn't actually in the piece because it would have been too complicated to put it in. Mm-hmm. But originally, we met in 2005 at the end of my fourth year of university. I was in a tribute show, and he knew one of the other performers because of a show that she was in, that he was a musical director for back then called Project Fame.
Mm-hmm. I remember Project Fame.
Yeah. So, he was coming to support her. And at that stage, I had his first CD. I was obviously a huge fan. And being in Cape Town, we all thought he was colored, right? Everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody thought. Benjamin. Exactly. Benjamin is a colored surname. He sounds like he's this black dude. Who's this guy?
Sure. And then you saw him and you were like, oh, no.
Who's this short white Jewish guy? So I was like, so I brought my CD and I was like, hey, please sign. And I was a huge fan and you autographed it and everything.
Yes.
Fast forward, like, I don't know, 12 years or so. 2013, I was in Turkey doing a tribute show for 6 months. And in the middle of the tribute show, as I always do...
The entertainment business is hard. In Turkey, she just breezes past that. 3 months?
Oh, wait, it was actually 6 months.
Six months in Turkey doing a tribute show.
Yeah.
You couldn't have loved every minute of that. Some nights you must have wanted to kill yourself thinking, what am I doing?
You know, we actually were doing two shows. One was a Queen tribute and the other one was an 80s show, you know, which is quite cool. I mean, what was cool about it is that we had about 8 dancers, and so in the one show I would dance and sing, and the other one I would just sing. So it was.
But this is the hard slog that people don't see. They see you on a television show and they go, "Oh, she's so lucky. She made it. She's one of the lucky ones. Her talent was recognized." They don't think about those 6 months you had to spend on a stage in Turkey.
And some
trotting
of those,
out 80s hits like Gloria Estefan.
Oh, I wish for Gloria. There wasn't any Gloria. But, I mean, some of those audiences were, you know, Eastern European bloc kind of audiences.
Miserable people who sit there and look at you.
Don't enjoy life an iota.
Don't enjoy life.
Sure, like people from Budapest.
Exactly.
No, they never smile.
Oh, like Bucharest or whatever other places.
Bulgaria.
So, I was in the middle of that contract and... on a Friday in the middle of a 6-hour trek to our venue that evening, listening to RJ's music on my phone. And I was like, oh, I'm missing South Africa. The first track on the album has the Highveld Storm intro on it. And so I just tweeted him. I was like, oh, listening to your music, really missing South Africa right now. Wada, wada, wada. Brat tweets back. Lose my mind. No one else on the bus gets it. The only other two people, the black people, the two that were sleeping. And I was like, the people who would understand this are sleeping. No one else on the bus knew who the hell he was or would get it. So I was like, well, screw this.
And to translate, it's just such a waste of time because it's like it loses the essence of it. You're like, you know what? It's fine. Never mind. I mean, you won't get it.
Trying to explain to someone from like, the East, far East Rand, but like, no, he's this guy who does this, and this is
you're exhausted already.
Exactly. So back and forth, and that's how it basically started. It started off as a kind of social media interaction,
like so many good relationships. Okay, so now this is something that's for a lot of people it's confusing. If you marry a Jewish guy, you're expected to become Jewish. It hardly ever, it does happen, but it hardly ever happens that if a Jewish guy marries a girl who's not Jewish, that he converts out of Judaism.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen.
Hardly ever.
But Magyaring or converting is a hell of a process.
Oh, and totally.
Jesus, do they put rules in the way?
I mean, I met someone a few days ago the process usually takes 3 years.
Whoa. They want to make sure that you absolutely want to do this.
Yeah, not just because, I want to feel like doing it. Yeah. But this woman, she actually didn't want to do it, and it ended up taking her 9 years. And I'm like, I've got better things to do in my life.
That's a lot of time to spend with rabbis.
I'm sorry.
9 years.
In 9 years, I could learn French, Italian. Sure. 9 years.
You could do more tribute shows in Turkey.
But that was one of the first conversations we had, because I hadn't realized that for the kids to be Jewish, the mother has to be Jewish.
Yeah, because it comes through the mom. You know why?
Yeah. Because of Sarah?
There's the religious element.
Okay, good. You still have your 3 years.
The actual reason is you always know who the mother of the child is. See, you don't always know who the father is.
You think you may know,
you think you know, but I mean, how many people are walking around today and they're not actually their father's son? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Because you don't know. Snap. There's no way to absolutely be sure unless you do the DNA tests. And who's going to do that?
Oh, gosh.
But the mother, you know. And if it's your culture, it comes from the mother.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's a whole... It's such a rigmarole. But that was one of the first things that we spoke about.
But that's real. I mean, they kind of... It makes some sense. It's almost like going for therapy before you get married to somebody because you figure each other out.
Mm.
And if you're not dedicated, you're not going to go through this 3-year process.
Yeah.
If you don't really love him and he doesn't really love you, it'll break in the middle.
I mean, I that is definitely one way to look at it. But our way,
I would never do it,
Yeah, the way we looked at it was like, I love you for you, you love me for me. This is how we met. This is how we are. So take it as it is. I'm not going to expect you. Because technically, if I was religious enough, I would have had him convert.
Yeah.
And then we would have been right back at the same place anyway. So.
Don't get me started on like religion and stuff. But there may be some merit to the madness in that you really get to test yourself.
Oh, totally.
How serious am I about this guy?
I mean, but at the same token, the amount of research that I had to do, actually, for this piece alone, I kind of feel like I'm a bit more Jewish than he is, because...
You are.
I'll be like, listen, I'm trying to think of a holiday. I'm like, hey, love, it's Shavuot.
Shavuot the other day,
he's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, he doesn't know that. He's born into it, so he takes it for granted a lot of the time.
No, he just literally doesn't care.
Yeah, look, that's the other thing, too, is that a lot of people... You know, like a lot of people who are Zulu are like into the culture and they know the history and they care about the rituals and they name everybody by their proper names and they speak like old school Zulu.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are Zulu because they were born Zulu, but they don't really give a shit about that stuff. Yeah. To them, it's just, it's nice when you think about it, but you don't otherwise consider it very much.
Yeah. But I think...
Like Prince Harry doesn't think about being royal.
Right.
It's just what he used to.
Well,
no, it is. It's like I don't think he thinks about it that often.
It's nice perks.
He's used to it though. That's all he's ever been used to.
First of all,
I reckon. So, when in the show now you talk about, I mean, it's called From Cook Sisters to Kneindag.
No? It's actually may I correct you?
Cook sisters.
It's very different. There's a big difference between cook sisters and cook sisters.
What's the difference?
Talk to
us. So everybody generally in South Africa knows
this. This is us converting to colored, by the way.
Now we are.
Okay, I'm all for it.
This is like Cape, Cape Creole.
Okay,
it. So cook sister, everybody knows, is the Afrikaans twisted sweet treat. Super sweet. The cook sister is the names are obviously very similar, and there's lots of contention between which is the real one. But a koo sister is a Cape Malay donut, like a little donut, delicately spiced with cinnamon and aniseed and a few other spices, with desiccated coconut and syrup, and it's just...
That sounds much better, by the way.
That sounds more interesting than the cook sister.
And the cook sister is God, you bite into that.
Syrupy sweet.
You have diabetes in a bite.
Like, after one bite, you're like, I'm done.
Yeah. Type 2 diabetes.
I'm done.
Yeah, exactly.
So that sounds interesting.
So a koo sister is something that I grew up on every Sunday morning, and because it's a Cape Malay thing, it's mostly done by the Muslim aunties in the street. So next door, across the road, wherever, and you get a packet of 6 or 12 for the house, and that would be like a Sunday morning ritual, either before church or after church. So I mean, coming from Cape Town, that's such a kind of an integration of religious acceptance and tolerance, because we all just like literally grew up together. My neighbors on either side of me and across the road and two doors down, growing up, were Muslim. And whenever there was a Muslim wedding or a celebration or even the fast, they would always be knocking on the back door, be like, here's a plate of, food, because that's part of the tradition.
That's what people do,
So there was that great integration, for lack of a better word. So So the Kusista, so I think, is indicative of Cape Town because it's the melting pot. It's, you know, it's where everything arrived.
I love this. I think this show sounds like something a lot of people would enjoy. How do you feel about labels now? Still the same?
You know, I think it's some struggle with because the labels continuously come up and people expect you or to kind of pick a side in a lot of...
Well, I mean, also, if you're an artist and you can do, you can sing, you can dance, you can act.
Yeah.
Right. So if someone says you're just a singer, you get annoyed because they're not calling you an actress and a dancer.
Yeah,
as well.
I mean, to a small degree.
And you could be all these things.
Yeah, I mean,
you can
I don't
be
think
Jewish and you can be of a Christian culture and you can be from the flats and you can be a Joburg girl all at once.
Absolutely.
You're allowed to.
I mean, don't tell the Cape Townians that I love Joburg. God.
They get very upset. That's like a whole other area of trouble and problems.
Oh, man. Joburg is fabulous. I freaking love it. I really, really do. Obviously, Cape Town has its own issues and I get really tired of Cape Town after like 3 weeks. Like, literally, I literally can't handle it.
Ben was from there and he can't stand the place anymore.
I got like a 10-day threshold.
10 days. It's even less. But yeah, I mean, what's cool about this piece, I think, is that people really, the audience really has to investigate their own reactions to people within the country and their own biases. There's two moments in the piece, I think actually three, where I specifically highlight what it's like to be a person of color in this whole new environment. Because South African Jewish people, and this is a great generalization, so I apologize, but the South African Jewry seem to forget that they're not quite white. Like,
oh, that's interesting.
You know what I mean? Like, there's obviously different sects.
Oh, that's interesting.
But they're not quite white. But obviously, there was that benefit from apartheid. And so,
they were never really loved by the old regime either. You know?
Oh, no, not at all. No. But they were, on face value, there was that beneficiation, shall we say.
Sure.
So, the issues that come with that are extraordinary as a person of color because you start to hear words that you've never heard before and then you Google them and you realize what is actually being said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the equivalent of the K word. Kind of things that people seem to forget that you, hi, I'm here having supper and I'm a person of color.
Maybe it's Yiddish, they don't understand.
Exactly. And then people obviously assume that the way I sound means I look a certain way or behave a certain way or vice versa. Like yesterday, someone on a telemarketer thought I was a white lady. And I was like, no, not at all. So the accent also, people seems to confuse people. I don't know why. I think people have a...
Well, listen, on the phone these days, I make no call. Because I've spoken to people on the phone sometimes. I could swear that they're black and you meet them and... You're like, what?
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Make no assumptions.
No.
So, I think because the Joburg Jewish community, for a large part, is quite insular, there's not much exposure to what's
outside
really going on.
Yeah.
So, a lot of times, people don't realize that I'm from South Africa, from Cape Town, and I'm like, no, I'm South African, I'm from here. Oh, but you're so well spoken.
That's such a backhanded compliment. People still use that?
Yes.
She's so articulate.
I'm like, yes.
Yes, I could use my mouth.
Because you're expecting me to woof.
Exactly.
Well, the production runs until the 23rd of June at the Auto and General Theatre on the Square. You must go and get your tickets and go and watch the show now. Six performances a week. Chantel's going to do, she's going to go crazy with all of these performances.
I'm going to enjoy it.
You know it all by heart now.
Yeah, I was just
change
going
it a little bit every time.
No. We actually keep it very, I try to keep it very, like, word for word. Okay. Obviously, here and there, there's fluffs that happen. But
that's good, because then you don't run over time, you don't run under time, you know where you are every moment, you know?
It's
good.
An hour and 15 minutes,
I guarantee. People don't arrive and go, oh, we got a good show, and the people tomorrow are going to get a bad show.
Exactly.
You need to be consistent. All right, very good. It's called From Kusistas to Knedlach.
Yeah.
All right, very good.
Thanks so much for having me.
What a pleasure. Nice to see you. We used to see each other every week at Idol.
All the time.
You'd be sitting prime seats in the middle. Your husband musical directing the thing.
I get pictures from my mother every week that she took of a screen of me.
And you'd be on
there.
The TV, yeah. Sorry you had to have me in those pictures.
Oh, no.
All right, well, lovely to see you, Chantel, and all the best to you. And say hi to RJ for us.
Will do.
And good luck with the show. It sounds terrific.
Thank you.
All right, there we are. Go and see the show. Get your tickets ASAP. Here's what you need to know. The un-news for this morning. South Africa's economy has shrunk by 2% in the first quarter. Politicians are more concerned about renaming Cape Town International Airport, of course. Initially, it was suggested the airport should be named after Winnie Madikizela Mandela, but Jacob Zuma and his supporters believe Dudu Mieni should get the honor. Nobody has made a greater impact on South African aviation than Dudu. So it's a no-brainer, really. Henry Van Breda has started to make friends in Polsmore, finally. Turns out inmates had the wrong impression about who he was. They originally thought he was Oscar Pistorius, but now they know he's the family-killing Afrikaans kid from Stellenbosch. They're cool with him. Moral of the story? Even hardened gangsters have no time for people who murder their girlfriends. And finally, Eddie Jones has defended his team, being taken to Durban rather than Johannesburg ahead of the Ellis Park test. Jones said it's far easier to pick up girls in Durban, and after the season his players have just had, they need all the help they can get to restore some confidence. So look out, Durban. Coming up, a discussion, a conversation, a fun session we had with someone who came and read our personalities. It was an Enneagram that we did with Joni Petty, and you could find out all about what our personalities were, but also at the same time, figure out your own. She used her expertise to analyze me, the team, shed some light on who everybody is, good and bad. Stick around for that.
This is CliffCentral.com.